This episode of Market Foolery is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/fool. It's Wednesday, July 13th. Welcome to Market Foolery. I'm Chris Hill. Joining me in studio today, Jason Moser and Alex Scherer. Alex, thank you for driving down from the Commonwealth.
I made it safely.
You made it safely.
Kept my hands on the wheel.
That's good. Hey. We want all drivers to keep their hands on the wheel when they're driving. We are going to dip into the Fool mailbag today. We are going to talk about a deal in the energy industry. Let's start, however, with the retail industry. And we'll look out as we kick off earnings season, but let's start with the results from Prime Day. And I feel like I've seen this movie before, Jason. What you heard in the media from the media over the past 24 hours was about the snafus that Amazon was having last year. It was not so much technical snafus; it was more about how you were promoting this deal, and then this item was sold out, and some of the sort of odd items that they were selling. This year, there actually were technical problems. There were people who were going on Twitter and Facebook and other places talking about how they were trying to buy stuff and they were having checkout problems. Amazon issued a statement saying they were aware of them, they were working on them. So again, the media narrative is, we're not sure how this is going to go, and now the results are out, and it looks like another really great day.
Yeah, clearly they're onto something very big here, and I think probably the real question, the one we probably all want the answer to, we're probably not going to get the answer, is how many new Prime members did they get from this? Because I think ultimately that's really the goal here, is create awareness, sell a lot of stuff, and ultimately just continue to grow that Prime member base, because that really is what keeps the business model working for Amazon. It was a couple days ago, I guess, I made the argument. I mean, really, and Alex, I don't know how you feel about this, but like from an Amazon loyalist's perspective, I mean, we've been using Amazon for a long time. Mm-hmm. It's integrated into our family's business model, more or less. Mm-hmm. I mean, for us, isn't every day really Prime Day?
It really is, yeah. I charted my personal purchase history back to 1998, which, by the way, Amazon has everything.
Yeah.
And it's in that deep archiving. You can access it. And there was just a serious hockey stick of my purchases since becoming a Prime member. You got to think that that's true for everybody. And it is critical, obviously, critical to Amazon's business model. And, you know, the dollar sales growth from Amazon Prime Day is a number that's, you know, fun to try and key in on. But as Jason said, it's really going to be the Prime member number growth, and the advertising and goodwill that comes out of something like Prime Day is really critical for that.
And the statement that Amazon issued included, you know, percentages. Well, orders in the U.S. up more than 50%, international up more than 60%. It also included what is easily the understatement of the month from Greg Greeley, who is the VP of Amazon Prime. And this was in their press release announcing the results. And Greg Greeley says, after yesterday's results, we'll definitely be doing this again. Was that even on the table that they wouldn't do this again? I mean, after last year?
They're a test and learn type of company, right? So if the results were lackluster, then yeah, absolutely. Why not?
Are you serious?
Yes.
You really think if there was some significant problem yesterday, they would say, you know what, we're not doing this?
Oh, no, not if it was a one-time issue that they sort of discovered and said, oh, well, this is a glitch, and therefore we're not going to repeat. No, certainly not. But if results were lackluster, if the press coverage wasn't there, if the new member signups weren't there, yeah, sure, they would absolutely. You know, it's not like the Fire Phone is still around, is it? I mean,
no,
they're happy to pull something off the shelf.
And I think
selling.
With the Fire Phone, we also look at something like that and recognize that we all probably could have guessed from the very beginning that Fire Phone was not going to succeed. But I don't think that was necessarily the point with that product as much as it was the technology that went into the Fire Phone in ways that they can leverage that technology beyond just that one little device. And so that's what Amazon's really good at, is not only, as Alex mentioned, testing and learning, but then being able to leverage technology in different fashions, because ultimately, you know, what they are doing now when it comes to the technology, I mean, 10 years ago, we really wouldn't have thought about Amazon as a device company, would we? I mean, it had the Kindle. But, I mean, today it is
which
a
I just bought
fledged,
on Prime Day.
I did, too. I bought a new Paperwhite. My wife looked at me when I told her when we got home. She's like, yeah, I knew you were going to do that. And I was like, how could I not? I mean, I'm saving $30.
Did you purchase it through Alexa?
No, I didn't. But
oh,
I have
I
made
did that.
Purchases
extra
through,
10 bucks off.
I've made purchases through Alexa, and it's very fun to do. I'm always a little bit nervous that she's going to get the order wrong, but I also like asking Alexa where my order is, because then she'll give you the updated tracking as to what's going on. But going back to the device narrative here, I mean, when you look at the number of devices they are selling now and the pace at which they're moving and developing the Echo, it's amazing to think about. But, I mean, really, Amazon is at the forefront of the connected home movement here. And you look at companies like Google and Apple now, I think they're really trying to catch up. And the more time that passes by here, the more difficult it's going to be for those behemoths to really gain, I think, a lot of credibility with consumers who have become very used to using Amazon devices, because you can use those devices to kind of live your everyday life. And I think that with Prime Day, for the people who are looking at Prime Day and thinking, well, I can get lower prices somewhere else, that may be. But I think that folks who are looking at Amazon as just being the low-cost provider are really missing the point entirely, because with Amazon, it's not just about low prices, but it's about convenience. It's about customer service. And I think the question maybe 10 years ago with e-commerce was that consumers weren't going to be willing to wait to have something delivered to them, and they felt like the customer service experience was going to be difficult, especially if they return something or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think Amazon has blown both of those notions completely out of the water, which is why this Prime Day has been so successful, and I expect more of them to come.
So for me, the key takeaway here is not whether it was 30% growth or 40% growth or 50% growth. It's just one more nail in the coffin for the offline retail channel, and just one more demonstration of how habit-forming Amazon Prime membership is for the consumer. And what that means is, you know, it's no surprise that it's no surprise to anyone in the world that Amazon is a, you know, is going to continue to be a major growth driver for U.S. and global retail sales. But it just is one more example of how careful you need to be when you're trying to invest in the offline retail space.
So this week we officially kicked off earnings season. A lot of companies obviously still to report. You think back to last earnings season, one of the big narratives out of that was just how challenged general retail was. We saw some niche retailers having varying degrees of success.
Sure.
Any reason to think that this quarter is going to be slightly brighter for the general retailers?
Well, I think it was so dismal last quarter that there is a sort of expectation of a little bit of a bounce back. But what we're looking at here, you know, and the more you focus on Amazon, the more you see it, is that, you know, U.S. retail sales, we're seeing a moderate amount of growth, but basically 100% of that growth is being accounted for by the progress that Amazon's making on its top line. And so it's, you know, it's a real struggle. It's real lackluster for the offline retail space. But I don't think that's because the consumer is doing poorly. But I think it's just, you know, again, one more example of Amazon kind of taking it over.
I think also, if you look at the little pockets where retailers other than Amazon are witnessing success, I mean, you have to look at companies like Nike and Under Armour as clearly winners in developing their own direct-to-consumer spaces. I mean, that's not just e-commerce. It's their own stores. We've seen the threat that them building out their direct-to-consumer operations has posed to companies like Dick's Sporting Goods, for example. So there's a great example of a physical retailer that I think is really between a rock and a hard place, because they sell about 35% of the stuff that Dick's carries in inventory is Under Armour and Nike stuff. And so the better those direct-to-consumer operations become, the more of a threat it becomes to companies like Dick's Sporting Goods, for example. So there are pockets there, but again, that's very dependent on brand power and also the specific nature of the market they pursue. And I think athletic apparel and equipment is specific enough market where they can continue to win.
All right, let's move on to the energy industry. Kinder Morgan and Southern have agreed to a natural gas pipeline venture. Kinder Morgan is selling a 50% stake to Southern for the tidy sum of just shy of $1.5 billion.
Nice.
This looks on the surface like a slightly better deal for Kinder Morgan shareholders, certainly if you look at how the two stocks have reacted. There's not a huge divergence, but there's it's definitely looking like a better deal for Kinder Morgan.
I think this is a deal that actually benefits both companies and both companies' shareholders really well. The pipeline that that Kinder Morgan sold half of and then created a joint venture to manage together to Southern Company is one of the largest natural gas assets in the Southern United States, and Southern Company utility an integrated utility down there is the largest customer to that asset. So the fact that the customer now has a substantial sort of 50% ownership stake bodes well for the stability of the earnings of that, because they now have a vested interest in obviously as an owner and not just a consumer of being a part of that business. But really what it comes down to for the Kinder Morgan shareholder is not that they got one over on Southern Company and got a fantastic deal. They didn't. It was a modest multiple. It was about 10.5 times EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, amortization, debt, depreciation. That's not a particularly rich price, and so Southern Company didn't really suffer for having made that purchase. But for Kinder Morgan shareholders, this is really all about the balance sheet. They had a growing debt problem last year into the energy crisis. Their earnings profile didn't really move that much, but they made a series of moves where debt just grew and grew and grew on the balance sheet, and eventually the ratings agencies came calling and said, this isn't going to work for us. And what it resulted in was Kinder Morgan slashing their dividend by 75% to try and refocus on paying down debt, getting a little bit of growth in earnings rather than distributing all that cash to shareholders. That absolutely clobbered the stock. It was, in my opinion, absolutely the right move. I'm a Kinder Morgan shareholder coming out of that decision having been made. But this, as well as other pipeline sales that Kinder Morgan has had over recent months, really is focused on getting that debt load down so that they can start to refocus on maybe incrementally raising the dividend. And I think this is going to put them in the right spot to do that.
I was going to say, Jason, I think the last time we talked about Kinder Morgan on this show, it was that they had cut their dividend by 75%.
We got a couple of questions on that one.
So among other things, this is a welcome bit of good news for Kinder Morgan and for shareholders.
Sure thing. I mean, Kinder Morgan is sort of that toll booth style of business. It's really attractive from the perspective of an income investor because it was able to really provide sort of a reliable income stream in the form of dividends, whereas the story was more focused on the income and probably less focused on the potential there for capital gains and the actual share price. It's not to say we won't take the capital gains either. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'll take both. But I think that given the trouble that the energy industry has seen over the past couple of years, along with Kinder Morgan's balance sheet and cutting that dividend, that was sort of the trifecta that really pummeled the stock. I think this is a great step in the right direction. I think Alex is exactly right. They want to get back to doing what they do best and making sure that they can instill confidence in their investor base that they are going to be a source for reliable income. I know they hated cutting that dividend at the time they did it, but it no question was the right move, especially given the nature of the industry at that point. So it's nice to have assets that other people want, right? You don't have to go commanding any real premium. You're selling something that someone else wants. It's a win-win for both parties involved, and I think for Kinder Morgan shareholders, and I'm not one, but I think this is a real win for them, and I think it gets that company back to being that steady dividend player that it really wants to be.
Last question on Kinder Morgan, Alex. You look at over the past year, this is a stock that's basically been cut in half.
Mm-hmm.
From a valuation standpoint, do you like where this company is right now, or
I do. I think it's got a lot of promise as a sort of stable, moderate growth company as it reinvests a lot of their cash flow because of the dividend cut, but it also at the same time has opportunity to pay down debt and maybe start incrementally raising that dividend, which is at a 2.5% yield right now, which is nothing to sneeze at in our negative interest rate world. But 2.5% is not a stock that income investors would seek out to saying wow. But this is 2.5% that is basically back on track now to be a moderately growing dividend as well as a moderately growing earnings or distributable cash flow profile. So, yeah, it's a company that I own and I'm very happy to own.
All right, guys, before we dip into the full mailbag, I want to say a word about Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. If you've ever bought a home, you already know how frustrating and time-consuming getting a mortgage can be. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century by taking all the complicated, time-consuming parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. With Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button, helping you get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your own financial situation. And the thing is, you can do it all on your phone or tablet. So if you're looking to refinance your mortgage, or if you're someone who's buying a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/fool. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Marketfoolery at fool.com is our email address from Kakoa Davidson in Bellingham, Washington. I just purchased the Vanguard Energy ETF. Other than oil prices and net asset value, what ways can we monitor the performance of the companies in ETFs? That's always a little bit of the challenge, isn't it, with an ETF?
So like
for all of the pros of the ETFs, they're not quite the level of transparency that you get with individual stocks.
No, but almost as
close.
Transparent, because it's not a closed-end fund where you don't have a view to what's going on inside the ETF. If any owner of the Vanguard Energy ETF is interested in understanding what it is they own, it's very simple to go to the Vanguard website or a Google search and look up Vanguard VDE Holdings. And what you'll find out is very easy to find a list of the top 10 holdings. And in this case, let me take a quick step back. When you buy an ETF, what the objective is to own a wide swath of either an entire market or an entire industry. In the case of the VDE ETF, it's the energy industry, and furthermore, it's the largest companies inside of the energy industry. And so when you own this company, going to the Vanguard website and looking up the top 10 holdings, what you'll find is ExxonMobil and Chevron are the two top holdings, and together they are a massive, it's actually a very concentrated piece of the total pie. Let me look up the weightings. Yeah, it was 22% of the fund is made up of ExxonMobil stock, and another 13% is made up of Chevron stock. So this is 35% of what you bought are two companies. So you're actually not getting quite the diversification that you might think you would be.
I was just going to
say. But it is easy enough to see, and following each of the constituent holdings, you don't need to follow 1,000 different holdings. If your ETF has 1,000 stocks, you really just need to, look at the top 10, for instance. And in this instance, 62% of the holdings is in 10 companies. And so, what you're buying is exposure to basically the very largest of the largest integrated oil companies in the United States.
Stability.
Well, I don't know about stability. This is an energy ETF.
Right. Slightly more stability?
Absolutely more stability than you're not wildcatting or buying, debt-laden Canadian energy or anything like that. You're buying Exxon, Chevron, Schlumberger, Occidental, and on down the line. So these are going to be the largest players. But this is also an industry where there's been a pretty wide move where the sort of lower quality energy companies have really just gotten absolutely clobbered, while the Exxons and Chevrons have not had the massive kind of sell-off. So this is not a deep value kind of buy. This is, definitely a more defensive purchase for anybody interested in owning the energy sector.
Yeah, I think a couple of points that Alex makes here is knowing what, you go into an ETF and the basic objective is they're knowing that you're going to be getting sort of a broader diversity exposure to whatever market you're pursuing. But it's also worth knowing what you own. You don't have to get maybe as granular as assessing the performance of every company in the ETF, for example, but you look at whatever ETF you may be considering and looking at the heavy hitters in that fund, right? The big holdings in that fund can at least give you an idea of what companies you have the most exposure to. Then you can certainly dig down a little bit more to understand how those companies are performing. But I think generally speaking, the nature of the ETF is so that you don't have to necessarily dig in so much. You can feel a little bit better about sort of the broader diversification.
Alex Scherer, Jason Moser, guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thank you.
As always, people on the program may have interest in the stocks they talk about, and the Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against. So don't buy or sell stocks based solely on what you hear. That's going to do it for this edition of Market Foolery. The show is mixed by Dan Boyd. I'm Chris Hill. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.